To see you. Very good. So, I think probably you all know why we're here, but in case you didn't, this is one of our Digging Deeper evenings, when we spend a significant amount of time just looking into a book or a theme from the Bible together. And this particular evening, I've chosen to look at this particular theme of the Sabbath. Now, I don't know how many of you grew up in Christian homes. Quite a few. So what are some of your memories of growing up in a Christian home on a Sunday? Heather?
No sweets,
no TV. No sweets, no TV.
No playing out.
No shopping.
No shopping,
definitely no shopping.
Going
to the park and not being allowed on the swings, but not having ice cream because that involved... We were making the ice cream man work, and so we couldn't have an ice cream. Yeah.
No, definitely
no hanging out the washing. No, that was a public confession of guilt, wasn't it? That we are working on the Sabbath day. Here's the evidence. Yes. Yeah. Quite. So, I mean, we could go on and on. I'm sure we've all got our own stories to tell. Maybe if we grew up in a Christian home in that era, but Sunday was a day of restrictions. I mean, most things you've said to me off the cuff were things that you couldn't do, were not allowed to do. It was a day of thou shalt nots, a Sunday in the Christian household that I grew up in, and which apparently some of you grew up in similar places too. And over my lifetime, I think I've been, as many of you, I'm guessing, because I know some of you and I know what you do on Sundays, we've been on a bit of a journey away from that restrictive thou shalt not approach to Sunday. And I wonder sometimes whether that journey has been well thought through, a reaction against something rather than towards something. And I wonder if we've ended up in a wholly helpful place on the journey we've been on. So I'm not here tonight, you know me, I think mostly well enough to know, I'm not here to tell you this is what you should and should not do on Sunday, far from that. But what I want to do is to kind of map something of what the Bible says about Sabbath, Old Testament and New Testament, how the very first Christians in the first couple of centuries handled that idea, and then think about some contemporary responses to the idea of Sabbath. And I'm going to offer you at least two. And then we'll have a bit of a conversation about where you think we've got to and how you want to react and respond. Is that okay? If it isn't okay, no shame in leaving now. But that's what's going to happen. Just to say as well that if you want to put your hand and ask a question when I'm in full flow, feel free to do that. Otherwise, I'll just keep flowing. So let's start from the beginning. So this is going to be sort of a chronological journey to start with. Just three foundation texts in the Bible which alert us to this thing called Sabbath. Right back in the Old Testament, the first is in Genesis chapter 2, where we read, on the seventh day, God finished the work that he had done, and he rested. The Hebrew word there is Shabbat, which is where we get the idea of Sabbath from. God rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. So that is the capstone of the creation story. We, human beings, appearing on day six, are not where the whole thing was headed. We're not the point of it all. But the story ends on day seven. This is where the story is headed. On day seven, we read about God who rested. That's where the whole creation account is headed. Next, we'll fast forward a little bit to the book of Exodus in the Ten Commandments, where in the middle of the Ten Commandments, we've got the first few commandments about loving and honoring God, and then we've got the last few commandments about the way we treat one another, not stealing from one another, not committing adultery with one another's husbands or wives, and so on. And in the middle, the hinge commandment is the Sabbath commandment, which joins together concerns about God and concerns about neighbor. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. For 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock or the alien resident in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that's in them, but rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it. Now, the first thing I want to point out is that when it says that God rested in Exodus, it uses a different Greek Hebrew word than the one that appears in Genesis 2. Genesis 2, God Shabbats, he rests. The word just means stop, desisting, doing nothing. But here it's a different word, nuha, and I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so that may be a bad pronunciation, but I'm just pointing out they're different words, and there is some significance to that, as we'll see. Notice there that the commandment to keep Sabbath is founded in creation. So the reason for doing it is because this is what God did on day 7 of the creation account. Notice, incidentally, what isn't there. Can anyone spot what isn't there? I mean, that's a rather strange question, thinking about it. There's lots of things that aren't there. Ice cream, for example. But something that we might expect. Yes, it says rest. What doesn't it say? It doesn't say worship. So one of the things that we assume Sabbath and Sundays are about, and I will pick those two things apart as we go on, but for the moment I'm putting them together. There is no command that this is a day of worship, it's a day of rest, just as God rested. As you know, the book of Deuteronomy is a kind of a summary of the first four books of the Bible, when there's a bit of a recapitulation of the story. Moses reminds Israel of where they've been and what God has said and done for them. And so we get a repeat of the Ten Commandments in the book of Deuteronomy. And this is how it reads when the Sabbath command is repeated in the book of Deuteronomy. Observe the Sabbath day and keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. For 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male and female slave or your ox or your donkey, or any of your livestock, or the resident alien in your towns, so that your male and female slave may rest as well as you. I think that's lovely. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Now, can you spot that the rationale, the reason for keeping Sabbath has shifted a little bit? In the first Exodus commandment, the reason was because God rested. Here, the foundation of Sabbath is you should rest because you were slaves, but you were set free by God. The reason for keeping Sabbath is rooted in the Exodus. Remember, you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep Sabbath day. So it's something to do with having been treated harshly, brutally, by Pharaoh as his slaves, and the difference that it means to be set free by God. Pharaoh didn't give them a minute off. God gives them a whole day off. It's a very different God that has set them free from the one that set himself up over Egypt in their past. See the contrast that's being drawn there? Some of you can. Some of you are wondering. So that's just to open up the main texts. The Genesis text where God rested, and then the two commandments. And this is why the whole of the rest of the Bible wrestles with these things, because they come as divine commandments. You shall keep the Sabbath day. It's a holy day. So let's just reflect a little bit more on the Genesis text, and to think about what does it mean that God rested? What does it mean that God rested? He stopped working. Certainly he did that. But did he stop doing anything? Is that an adequate explanation of Sabbath? John's shaking his head.
Yeah, he's still working, even now,
isn't he? Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So God stopped the work of creation, but he didn't stop working. So in what sense did God rest? If we imagine God took a period of time off, then the Bible texts that talk about all things being upheld by his strong right hand make us wonder, well, how could he do that when he was resting? He's breaking Sabbath. You see the conundrum we can get into. So let's think about this for a minute. So let's go back to those two words that are used. I'm leaning a little bit on some thinking that comes from this book that I've flagged up to you before, The Lost World of Genesis 1 by John Walton. He says this, the Hebrew Shabbat, which we find in Genesis 2, has the basic meaning of ceasing. This cessation leads to a new state described by the verb nuah. This describes the state that you enter, a position of safety, security, or stability, but not necessarily in activity. When God rests in Exodus, it is nuah. In other words, God has entered, in Genesis 1, what God was doing, remember, was overcoming the forces of chaos. He was creating space in the cosmos that he was bringing it into being for human beings to live with him on this planet Earth. God was laboring against, we read, in the beginning there was chaos and God spoke, and you know the Genesis 1. What's the rest that's described points to is what happens when that work has been done and a new order of things has emerged. So that's another quote from the book. What does divine rest entail? Most of us think of rest as disengagement from the cares, worries, and tasks of life. What comes to mind is sleeping or taking an afternoon nap. But in the ancient world, rest is what results when a crisis has been resolved, or when stability has been achieved, when things have settled down. Consequently, normal routines can now be established and enjoyed. For deity, for God, this means that the normal operations of the cosmos can now be undertaken. This is more a matter of engagement without obstacles rather than disengagement without responsibilities. Can you follow that? Does that sound a bit too complicated? So, what we're pointing to here is that when God settles down and rests, it's a sign of his victory and his rule and reign starting. That the enemy has now been overthrown and that he can now enter into a period of enjoying that which, as it were, that which has been created by his creative struggles and creative work. So in Psalm 132, we find the word again, let's go to his dwelling place. Let's worship at his footstool. Rise up, O Lord, and go to your resting place, not his bedroom. You and the ark of your might, for the Lord has chosen Zion. He's desired it for his habitation. This is my resting place forever. Here I will reside, for I have desired it. The idea of a resting place, of course, these were what were called the Psalms of Ascent, when the ark was carried into the temple and when God was worshipped, and they go up the temple hill to worship, and they would go to see where God was resting. But it doesn't mean where God was sleeping. It means where God was ruling and reigning and majestically seen to be in control of the land of Israel. So the idea of God's rest, which we are invited later in the Bible to enter, is not to enter into a period of inactivity. It's something richer than that. Are you at all following me? A few nods of heads. Okay. Some of this we'll circle around it. So if it's a bit confusing, then we'll come back to it. So what we see in those Old Testament texts is that the Sabbath was a holy day. It was a portion of Israel's time dedicated to God, a time to enter into God's own rest. There is nothing to strive against. There is nothing to create. There is nothing to achieve. This is a period when we can celebrate that which has been given to us, rather than when we have to create and be in control and be in charge. And this idea of it being a period in time, there's a lovely, beautiful book. Not all of you will appreciate it, I guess. It's written by a Jewish thinker called Abraham Joshua Heschel, and it's called The Sabbath. And any book that's written about the Sabbath will refer to this book, whether it's a Christian book or a Jewish book, will refer to this. It's kind of a seminal book on the Sabbath, and it's beautifully written. And if you were to read this, you would find the most beautiful descriptions of how he, as a Jew, sees the Sabbath, this wonderful, rich gift from God. And one of the bits of metaphor that he uses, He calls them, the Sabbaths are our great cathedrals, the architecture of time. Isn't that a great phrase? There is no reference in the record of creation to any object in space that would be endowed with the quality of holiness. The seventh day is like a palace in time with a kingdom. It's not a date, but an atmosphere. It's a very rich understanding of Sabbath. And I love this idea of being a cathedral in time. He contrasts the creation of stuff, what he calls space there, with time. And he says we give a lot of our lives to space, to stuff, to doing stuff and creating stuff and working with stuff and fixing stuff. But he says God lives in this great cathedral, and God's created this cathedral in time. We also live in time. And God has created this weekly space into which we can enter and enjoy God's rulership and God's reign and God's kingship without feeling that we have to achieve anything ourselves. It's a lovely picture. Yes? It's on the screen there. But an atmosphere. Yeah. Incidentally, those of you that might be scribbling, I can give you a set of these slides if that doesn't give you, saves you wrist ache by the end of the night. There's quite a lot of words on some of these. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, again, if you're interested in a Jewish perspective, which I think is always very helpful, then read it, because it's long for it. Look forward to it, to go to this space. So it's a holy day. It's the only thing in creation that's called holy. He makes the point, as several authors do, that there's nothing else in the creation account which is given the described as holy. It's a holy day. This is a holy day, we're told in Exodus, created as something special, set apart from the other days. But secondly, of course, it's a restful day. The emphasis of the Deuteronomy passage and the Exodus passage is that this is a day on which you shall not do any work. It's a weekly reminder that we are not in control and that God is. That there is a space to reflect on the fact that we are not going to make this world a better place by ourselves. We're not going to fix our problems by ourselves, but there is a God who has offered to do that. God is not like Pharaoh, as I've already said. It's a restful day when we don't have to strive. But notice as well, in the Deuteronomy account in particular, but in both of the passages, it's a day for justice. You notice, I'm sure, when I read, 6 days you shall do your work, on the seventh day you shall rest, so that your ox and your donkey may have relief, and your home-born slave and the resident alien may be refreshed. One of the reasons for resting, and this perhaps comes back to the ice cream dilemma, where we're not allowed to have an ice cream because it means somebody else is working. There's a shadow of that in this, actually. That if we... But God in Israel, in his nation, in his people, wanted a day when there was social justice every week. there weren't any slaves, there weren't any workers, there was no one being put upon, there was no one skivvying. But actually everyone, even the donkey, had a day off every week. I think that's a lovely picture of Sabbath, rest. So this was sown into Israel's life, this idea of one day in seven being a holy, restful, just day. Not, as we've already pointed out, necessarily a day for worship, although it became that. It became a day when, particularly after the exile, when the synagogues were proliferated within Israel itself. So you know do you know what I referred to there? So in Israel's story was that they God resided amongst them in the tabernacle, the kind of porter worship center, the pop-up church thing in the wilderness. And then David was trying to build the temple, but Solomon built the temple. So there was a big worship space in the center of Israel, in Jerusalem. And that's where worship happened. But when they got taken away into exile, they didn't have the temple. In fact, the temple was destroyed. And so they developed a system of meeting in smaller groups, which became a pattern when they went back to the land for the synagogues that then proliferated around. They didn't have a big central temple, so the synagogues emerged as kind of what we might call local churches you don't have to go to Bristol Cathedral anymore because there's, you know, a church in Thornbury, if I can use that as a way of illustration. So there became a pattern, certainly when after they'd returned from exile, that the synagogues, you would go to the synagogue and worship and study and learn on the Sabbath day. But we read in the prophets that the Sabbath actually became a bone of contention. I think what I've tried to describe so far is that the Sabbath is a wonderful gift from God. And yet, that gift in the Old Testament, we see it's resented. Here's some words from Amos. "In that day, declares the sovereign Lord, the songs in the temple will turn to wailing. Many, many bodies flung everywhere. Silence. Why? Hear this, you who trample the needy and do away with the poor of the land, saying, when will the new moon be over that we may sell grain? And when will the Sabbath be ended that we may market wheat?" In other words, their lives of commerce and gain and acquisition had taken them over to the point where they couldn't wait for Sabbath to end. Sabbath became a frustration because they had to stop earning money. They had to stop getting rich for a day. And that was seen as, perhaps the reasons I've articulated about Sabbath being God's concern for the poor as much as for anything else, being an abuse of the poor and needy, because those who were making money were causing other people to work as well. And so this attitude was one of the reasons that Amos says God was going to judge them. So God did judge them, and they did go into exile. And in exile, they sought God, and God acted, and they returned, as you know. That's a very brief summary of the exile and return. But when they got back, one of the key figures there, of course, was Nehemiah, who began to rebuild Jerusalem. And in the book of Nehemiah, we read again some words that relate to their understanding of Sabbath. This is Nehemiah returning to Jerusalem. "In those days, I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys together with wine, grapes, figs, and all other kinds of loads. And they were bringing all this into Jerusalem on the Sabbath." You've got to imagine Nehemiah's tone of voice here. "Therefore, I warned them against selling food on that day. People from Tyre who lived in Jerusalem were bringing in fish and all kinds of merchandise and selling it in Jerusalem on the Sabbath to the people of Judah. I rebuked the nobles of Judah and said to them, 'What's this wicked thing you're doing, desecrating the Sabbath day? Didn't your ancestors do the same thing so that our God brought all this calamity on us and on this city?'" Notice how interpretation of God's judgment on Israel, the whole exile tragedy, Nehemiah puts on the desecration of the Sabbath. "Didn't your ancestors do these things so that our God brought all this calamity on us and on the city? Now you're stirring up more wrath against Israel by desecrating the Sabbath. So when evening shadows fell on the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I ordered the doors to be shut and not opened until the Sabbath was over." That'll learn them. "I stationed some of my own men at the gates so that no load could be brought in on the Sabbath day. Once or twice, the merchants and sellers of all kinds of goods spent the night outside Jerusalem. But I warned them, and I said, 'Why do you spend the night by the wall? If you do this again, I will arrest you.' Strangely, from that time on, they no longer came on the Sabbath. Then I commanded the Levites to purify themselves and go guard the gates in order to keep the Sabbath day holy." Can you see how in what high regard it was held, and how important they thought it was to God that they should honor the day that had been given?
Except for the guards.
Except for the guards, yes. Yeah, yeah. They probably had Sunday off. Yeah. Now, the whole period of history that we're then moving into, the period that's between the Old Testament and the New Testament, Israel are back in the land. Our New Old Testament, as you know, finishes with the book of Malachi, and there's a 400-year historical gap before we get to Matthew. And in those 400 years, Israel were so concerned that they kept the law because they felt that's why they'd gone into exile. They'd broken the law. That the scribes in particular, a group of people called the scribes, the scholars of the day, spent a lot of time trying to work out how not to offend God by breaking his law. And the Sabbath was a particularly rich place for them to spend their time, making up laws in order that this law would not be broken again. And so they began to regulate the Sabbath with all kinds of commandments that we don't find in the Old Testament. There were some commandments in the Old Testament about what you could and couldn't do on the Sabbath. For example, you could not do. You could not light a fire, we read in Exodus 35. You could not carry a burden, we read in Jeremiah 17. And you couldn't travel in Isaiah 58. But of course, the question is, well, what constitutes a journey? At what point does walking across a room become a journey? And what constitutes a burden? Is it carrying a rucksack with bricks in? Is it carrying a handkerchief in your pocket? So they had a field day with this need to interpret the few indications there were in the Old Testament about what you can and cannot do. And here's a passage from a book called the Book of Jubilees, which was written between the Testaments. You'll find it if you've got one of those Bibles that have the Apocrypha in. But if you're good Protestants, you probably haven't got one of those. But we're going to read it here, and I hope I don't desecrate Thornbury Baptist Church by reading it here. 6 days shall you labor, but on the seventh day is the Shabbat of Yahweh, your sovereign ruler. In it you shall do no manner of work, you and your sons and your men servants and your maid servants and all your cattle and the sojourner also who is with you. And the man that does any work on it shall die. There. Never mind being arrested. Whoever desecrates that day, whoever lies with his wife, or whoever says he will do something on it, that he will set out on a journey, this isn't to do it, but if you say you're going to do something on it, will set out on a journey thereon in regard to any buying or selling, and whoever draws water thereon, which he had not prepared for himself on the sixth day, and whoever takes up any burden to carry out of his tent or out of his house, shall die. You shall do no work whatever on the Sabbath, on the Shabbat day, save what you've prepared for yourselves on the sixth day, so as to eat and drink and rest and keep Shabbat from all work on that day and to bless Yahweh, your sovereign ruler. Notice that now worship has emerged as a theme of Shabbat, who's given you a day of festival and a Kodesh, or a holy day, and a day of the holy kingdom for all Israel is this day among their days forever. And, he goes on, every man who does any work thereon, or goes on a journey, or tills his farm, or whether in his house or in any other place, and whoever lights a fire, or rides on any beast, or travels by ship on the sea, or whoever strikes or kills anything, or buys an ice cream, or slaughters a beast or a bird, or whoever catches an animal or a bird or a fish, or watches TV, or whoever fasts, incidentally, which is seen as a work, or makes war on the Shabbats, the man who does any of these things on the Shabbat shall die, so that the children of Israel shall observe the Shabbats according to the commandments regarding the Shabbats of the land, as it's written on the tablets. Which, of course, it wasn't written on the tablets, but that's an interpretation, an expansion. Sorry? Yeah. Well, you can see how seriously they took it. This was right up to the time of Jesus. This was the culture that Jesus walked into when he emerged onto the scene of world history. This was the attitude to Sabbath that was prevalent in his nation at the time. So by the time of Jesus, observance of Sabbath was widely known. It was widely known amongst the nations that Israel, this was a distinctive thing of Israel. I think, as far as I know, maybe wrong, but as far as I know, they were the only nation whose God said, take a day off every week. You shall do nothing. The other gods were rather more demanding than Yahweh in that regard. And some people saw it as a thing to ridicule the Jews for. Others were admiring of this social novelty of having a whole day off once a week by divine decree. And Jews, interestingly, were excused from military service in foreign military forces since the foreign powers knew that they would not march or do anything on the Sabbath. So, the multiple interpretations of what it meant to keep Sabbath, what I put on the screen is just one of many interpretations of what it meant to keep Sabbath. It kept the religious parties of Jesus' day busily disagreeing about the whole thing. Everyone admitted that Sabbath was to be kept, and Jews almost universally met in synagogues on the Sabbath day for prayer, scripture readings, and debate. And for most Jews, despite the laws, it was a time... Sorry? Well, apparently not, no. So it was, despite all those prohibitions, as I said from this book, which was obviously written much more recently than that, it was a joyful day. It was a day they looked forward to in the main. Yes. Yes. That was what the meaning was, yes. Yeah. No, it wasn't an Ananias and Sapphira situation. It was a more of a... Yeah. Yeah. So, we've walked through the Old Testament. So, what I've tried to describe to you so far, you'll understand, is a journey through the Old Testament. I'm not trying to say this is it. We're on a journey here. And we've got to Jesus at the beginning of the New Testament. I've set the scene for the world that Jesus inhabited. Meg. So holiness was to share in God's character, God's world. So only God is holy. So any holiness that we have is attributed to us by God. We cannot make ourselves holy. We can be made holy. So and holiness was about a specialness, a distinctiveness that carried the flavor of God's being and God's character and God's mind and heart. So it was a different, a set apart. So in terms of the day, it was a set apart day, sharing in God's rest. Holiness in the Bible is given and sought after. So God makes things holy by decree. But then those that are made holy are urged to pursue that holiness which they have been given. So in the book of Hebrews, it says, pursue that holiness without which you will not see God. But the New Testament is quite clear that we couldn't possibly, by pursuing God, make ourselves holy. The gift of holiness is just that. It's a gift. It's a calling to be set apart for God's purposes. Is that enough for now? We can have a digging deep on holiness maybe, but let's move on into this. Jesus, you will know that there were a number of incidents where Jesus, who himself clearly kept Sabbath in a fashion. We read in the Gospels, though, that Jesus sort of started to redefine, he had his own take on what Sabbath was about. So in Mark 2, we read an incident. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the cornfields, and as they made their way, his disciples began to pluck heads of grain. And the Pharisees said to him, look, why are they doing what's not lawful on the Sabbath? They were walking and harvesting. And he said to them, have you never read what David did when his companions were hungry and in need of food? He entered the house of God when Abiathar was high priest and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat. And he gave some to his companions. This refers back to an incident in Samuel where David's on the run and he needs bread and he goes into the temple and takes the bread. Then he said to them, the Sabbath was made for humankind and not humankind for the Sabbath. Now, what I pointed out to you in the Exodus and Deuteronomy, you can see what Jesus is getting to. This is supposed to be a blessing. This is supposed to be something that enriches your life. The Sabbath was made for human beings. You weren't made to keep Sabbath. Sabbath was made to keep you. Yeah? And then he says, shockingly, so the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Can you see, given everything that I've said about the specialness of Sabbath and the roots of Sabbath in creation and God and God's decree, for Jesus to suddenly say, by the way, I'm in charge of this thing. The Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Even of the Sabbath, implying this is probably one of the highest holy things that you can think of, you Jewish folks that I'm talking to. And even the highest of holy things that you can think of, I'm Lord of that too. Again, in Mark 3, we read, he entered the synagogue and a man was there who had a withered hand. They watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, come forward. Then he said to them, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill? But they were silent. It's a fairly easy question, really, isn't it? You might have thought. But they dug a hole, and Jesus was inviting them to jump into it, basically, wasn't he? He looked around at them with anger. They didn't read that passion attributed to Jesus very much. He was grieved at their hardness of heart and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. So Jesus did not, I want to suggest to you, contra what sometimes you might have heard, abolish Sabbath. What Jesus did was he drew it back to its original intent, which was to be a source of blessing for the Jewish people. When rules about Sabbath keeping obscure the doing of good to people, the law has become misused. Exactly, exactly. So Jesus was showing what this law was all about. He was the word fulfillment. He was the end. He was the thing that the law was traveling towards. This Jesus was the fulfillment of what the law was headed towards. He filled it up. Jesus is presenting himself as God. When he says, "I'm Lord of the Sabbath," that's what they would have understood. There was only one Lord of the Sabbath. So this was a stark claim. The one who can ultimately interpret Sabbath was Jesus himself. So, what did the early Christians do? Well, in the book of Acts, we find that the early Christians clearly used the habit of Sabbath, of meeting on a weekly basis. Certainly Paul did, didn't he? Through the book of Acts, we read that Paul joined with his Jewish believers on the Sabbath day. We read in Antioch, Pisidia, they went into the synagogue and sat down. The people urged them to speak about these things again the next Sabbath day. 16, on the Sabbath day we went outside the gate by the river, this was in Philippi, wasn't it, where we supposed there was a place of prayer, and we sat down and spoke to the women who'd gathered there. So Paul was in the habit of, as a Jew, of keeping Sabbath. And he always started his missionary activity by joining with his fellow Jews on that day to worship. And yet, the challenge then became, what happens when people who are not Jewish start coming to faith? All we've described so far, from the Old Testament up to this point, has been the Sabbath within the context of Judaism. Now, in God's eternal plan, people who were not Jewish are joined to the Messiah's people. What's the expectation for them? Is the Sabbath day a requirement of being part of the Jesus movement or not? And you remember that incident in the book of Acts when Paul reports back to Jerusalem and tells them how people have been coming to faith all around Turkey and Syria and so on. And there's a debate, well, how can this be? And then the leaders of the church in Jerusalem agree this is a wonderful thing. And then they offer some rules. Well, that's fine, they're welcome, but let's make sure they don't eat any blood that's been meat with blood in it. Remember, they came up with a short list of laws. What's striking to me is that what wasn't on that list was, and of course, they should keep Sabbath. It wasn't enjoined on these new Gentile churches. There were a couple of rules that were, presumably to avoid causing offense in this Jewish-Gentile melting pot that there was in the New Testament. But there was no law that was passed on to Paul to hand on to the Gentile churches that they should not, that they should keep Sabbath. And so, what we see is that there was a bit of a dividing line for Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. So Jewish Christians were quite at liberty to keep Sabbath. Gentile Christians had no requirement that they did so. In this book, which is fat enough probably to put you off ever wanting to read it, which is called From Sabbath Day to Lord's Day, We read this. By its silence in regard to any Sabbath controversies, Acts suggests that Jewish Christians must have continued to keep the Sabbath. The Sabbath was an institution too central to Judaism for it to have been tampered with without provoking hostile reaction and persecution. But there is no record of persecution on this account. Instead, the early Christians seem to have taken advantage of Sabbath observance as an opportunity to preach Jesus as the Messiah. So, this might sound a poor way of putting it, but they sort of used the opportunity that Sabbath presented to present Jesus as Messiah. But when Paul is writing to the Gentile churches, as he does in Colossians, he says this: "When you were dead in trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made you alive together with him when he forgave all us our trespasses, erasing the record that stood against us with its legal demands. He set this aside." That record that was set against us with its legal demands is not all the things that I've done wrong. That record that set against us with legal demands was the Old Testament law. That's what condemned us in Paul's view. The law was what condemned us and made us realize we needed a savior. In Galatians, he calls it was our school teacher that showed us that we needed some help to be saved. So he erased that record that stood against us. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and made a public example of them, triumphing over them in it. Therefore, you Gentile Christians in Colossae, don't let anyone condemn you in matters of food and drink, which of course were really important in the Jewish law, what you ate and what you didn't eat. Don't let anyone condemn you in matters of food and drink, or of observing festivals, or new moons, or Sabbaths. These are only a shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. So Paul always would say, and this is Jill Murray's point about Christ being the fulfillment of the law, Jesus was now the culmination, the termination of that Old Testament law. And now it's interpreted and understood through him, not independently of him. There was no part of the Old Testament story that kind of escaped Jesus and did a kind of a U-turn around him and emerged the other side untouched. Does that make sense? So the only way, Paul says, is to understand this, is to say, well, those were shadows. They told us something. They were important, but they weren't the reality. They were a shadow that Jesus cast back in time, if you like. But now we've seen Jesus, we understand what those shadows were actually pointing to and what they were all about. In Romans, he does a similar thing. He says, who are you? Remember Romans, there's a squabbling between the Jewish and the Gentile Christians. That's what Romans is all about, sourcing out this division there is in the church. And he says this, who are you to pass judgments on servants of one another? It's before their own Lord that they stand or fall, and they will be upheld, for the law is able to make them stand. Some judge one day to be better than another, clearly pointing to Sabbath, while others judge all days to be alike. Let all be fully convinced in their own minds. Those who observe the day, observe it in honor of the Lord. So Paul is putting this, again, the Greek word is adiaphora, matters that are disputable, where we can beg to differ. And Paul is saying there may be some people in this church in Rome, which is made up of Jews and Gentiles, who still think they want to keep Sabbath. Let them do it. There may be some who feel that actually this day has been fulfilled in Christ, and they don't see the need to keep the Jewish regulations about Sabbath. Let them do it. Don't judge one another. Who are you to judge somebody else's servant? If I keep Sabbath to the Lord, then the Lord understands that and honors that. If I keep all days the same to the Lord understands that and honors that. That's Paul's approach to the Sabbath. So, let me just move on. Some of you are looking like you're needing a break. So let me just move on and I'll just press fast forward a minute. So there is a trajectory which is not clear and certainly not a law, but which the New Testament seems to point out, that the Christians began to meet not on the Sabbath day, which of course was Saturday, but on Sunday, the first day of the week, which they called the Lord's Day. The Lord, pointing, of course, to Jesus' resurrection and ascension. The day on which Jesus was resurrected became the Lord's Day, the day when Jesus was declared Lord by his resurrection from the dead. Became the Lord's Day. Remember John, when he writes his account of resurrection, he labours the point, this is the first day of the week, this is the first day of the week, not the seventh day, this is the first day of the week, the first day of the week when Jesus was discovered. And so we see at 3 points, I got ahead of myself here, forget the first one a minute, I'll come back to that. So in Corinthians, Paul says, on the first day of every week, each of you is to put aside and save whatever extra you earn so that the collections need not be taken when I come. Now, he could have just been saying, put some money in your piggy bank on the first day of the week. But the inference is that he's saying, when you are together on the first day of the week, have a collection for the poor Christians. John, when he starts the book of Revelation, says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. And I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet. It seemed like the first day of the week, the Lord's Day, Resurrection Day, became of special significance to Christians, and they began to keep something on that day, which was a celebration of resurrection and new life. So that the quote on the top of the screen there, which comes from a document called the Didache, which is one of the very earliest documents of the Christian church outside of the New Testament, early in the first century. And it was a book of instructions about how to follow Jesus, basically. And the instruction by very early in the first century was that on the Lord's Day, you should assemble and break bread and give thanks, having first confessed your sins, that your sacrifice may be pure. So the habit of meeting on the Lord's Day quickly took root in the Christian churches. Also from that same century, the first century, so within 100 years or so of the New Testament writers and Jesus himself, we read from a man called Justin Martyr, who was called that because he was martyred and he was Justin. On the first day of the week, I've got my slides all mixed up here. This is the other third quote from the New Testament. This is Acts 20, Paul saying, on the first day of the week when we met to break bread, Paul was holding a discussion with them, since he intended to leave the next day. So that's the third text from the New Testament. Justin Martyr said, what Justin Martyr was doing was he was defending to the Roman emperor the life and practices of the Christians. He was trying to explain to the Roman emperor why the Christians did what they did. And he says, on the day that's called Sunday, all who live in the cities or in rural areas gather together in one place, and memoirs of the apostles and the writings of the prophets are read for as long as time allows. But Sunday is the day on which we hold our common assembly, since this day is the first day on which God, changing darkness and matter, created the world. And it was on this very day that Jesus Christ, our Savior, rose from the dead. Can you see what Justin does there? Rather brilliantly. He draws together the Old Testament rationale and the New Testament rationale. God who created everything and brought light out of darkness, and the God who raised his Son, the light of the world, out of the darkness of the tomb. Those two reasons are why we meet on the Lord's Day. Name me two better reasons, Emperor. So it was just a working day, remember. So they didn't have the extravagant luxury of a day off, because the first day of the week, there would have been work. It wasn't a universal thing. It wasn't that everybody had a big campaign to keep Sunday special. Somewhere they had to shoehorn in around their normal first day of the week activities, the celebration with other Christians of the Lord's Day, which continued for two centuries until a man whose name you would have heard before, called Emperor Constantine, came to rule in Rome. And Emperor Constantine worshipped the sun. He was a sun worshipper all his life. He became a Christian, or at least he professed coming to faith, but he kind of chose to keep that until a bit of a deathbed thing. It was kind of his passport in his back pocket. His religious practice was a worshipper of the sun. And so he passed a law. On the venerable day of the sun, let the magistrates and people residing in cities rest, and let all workshops be closed. In the country, however, persons engaged in agriculture may freely and lawfully continue their pursuits, because it often happens that another day is not so suitable for grain sowing or for vine planting, lest by neglecting the proper moment for such operations, the bounty of heaven should be lost. So he wanted to have his cake and eat it, basically. But you can see what he did now in a whole empire. He declared that the day of the sun, Sunday, should be a day of rest, at least if you lived in a city. And we still, until probably 20, 30 years ago, lived in the good of Constantine's law that Sunday should be a day of rest. It wasn't a biblical law, but it was a cultural phenomenon which took root in Europe and which was overlaid with a lot of Sabbath thinking from the Old Testament. And so the Sabbath laws, where you can't travel, you can't work, you can't do this, were overlaid on this mandatory day off, which society was now enjoying. And without really thinking about it, we had rejoined what Jesus had actually separated, the Old Testament practice of Sabbath, with the weekly habit of worship. Can you see how that happened? So, we're in the home straight now. Be encouraged. I want to suggest as I close that there are now two views on Sabbath. Well, there's three views, actually. One is, and I think this is quite common, Sunday's just a day like every other day. I'll do the washing, I'll go to the mall, and if I've got time to squeeze it in, I'll go to church. That's a bit unkind, isn't it? But I think for many people, Sunday has become just like a normal day with church as an option. All the statistics point to that. So committed churchgoers these days are deemed to be people that attend a place of worship at least twice a month. So the first view, which isn't one of my two views, so this is view zero, is that I think we've allowed the pendulum to swing so far that Sunday has ceased to be, or the Sabbath has ceased to have any resonance with us at all, apart from as an optional day of worship with other Christians. The first view, which is actually the second view now, I've added another view in, is what I've been describing. This shift from Sabbath day to Lord's day, that the Sabbath as a day of rest has been fulfilled in Christ, such that in one sense, every day is now Sabbath. For Christians, the first day of the week takes on fresh significance as the Lord's day, a day to gather and celebrate resurrection with other believers. That's, I think, a New Testament view of Sabbath. The Lord's day is now the day on which Christ, who has fulfilled Sabbath, what I haven't referred to is the passage in the book of Hebrews where it says, there is now a Sabbath rest for the people of God. I'm sorry, just time, I sort of slipped that by. What I think that means is that the work of creating our salvation, of overcoming our sin and the hostile forces that are set against us, has been done by Christ. We do not have to work to achieve our salvation now. But we enter into the rest, the enjoyment of that salvation that Christ has given to us, which is why on this first view I've said that rest has been fulfilled in Christ, so that in one sense every day is now Sabbath. Every day is the day in which we enjoy the freedom that Christ has brought for us. There is a second view, however, which doesn't culminate, is not the end of the journey I've taken you on tonight, but actually maintains that Sabbath is not rooted in Old Testament law, but in the very creation of the world. And therefore, it's not a legal issue, it's about entering into the rhythm of life that God has established in the world. It's what's called a creation ordinance. There's something about the way that God has ordered the world which requires this 1 in 7 day of rest. And that to live against that, to ignore that, is to live against the grain of the way that we're created to tick. And there are some very powerful advocates of this view. I just want to mention three as a close. One is Eugene Peterson, who wrote the Message version of the Bible. He, in a number of his books, there's a passage in here, Christ Plays in 10,000 Places. He writes lavishly about the importance of Sabbath for Christians. in our culture today. He described it as a focal practice. It's what keeps us focused on who we are and who God is. It's a space in the week that enables us to retune into the important things of life and our faith in God. He says it's a focal practice, keeps us tuned into God. The Hebrew word Shabbat simply means quit, stop, take a break. But it's also a word that draws us to the context for our work. Human not doing became a day of God honoring. Sabbath is a deliberate act of interference, an interruption of our work each week, a decree of no work, so that we're able to notice, to attend, to listen, to assimilate the comprehensive and majestic work of God, to orient our work in the work of God. I like that picture. I've because I love you and care for you, I photocopied the chapter or the section on Sabbath from his book. So if you want to take one of those away with you, you can take that and read it yourself. A second heavyweight, theological heavyweight, is a man called Walter Brueggemann, and he's written a book called Sabbath as Resistance, saying no, in capital letters, to the culture of now. He takes the same view. He says that Sabbath keeping is a way of making a statement of peculiar identity, just like the Jews did in the Old Testament, amid a larger public identity of maintaining and enacting a counter-identity that refuses mainstream identity, which itself entails anti-human practice and the worship of anti-human gods. So he's really big into justice. Understood in this way, Sabbath is a bodily act of testimony to alternative ways of being human. We are saying, this is not who I am. I'm not a cog in the world's machine. I'm not a worker. I'm not a producer. And so it's an act of testimony, and it's an act of resistance to pervading values and assumptions behind those values. We refuse to be sucked into the culture which says you are just a worker, you're just a performer, you're just a creator, you're just a doer. And we say, no, I'm not. I'm a worshiper. I'm a creation, not a creator. And so this is a powerful plea. So his chapters are, it's a resistance to anxiety, it's a resistance to coercion, it's a resistance to exclusivism. In other words, everybody's in on this. And it's a resistance to multitasking, which is a way of being distracted and taking no one very seriously because I'm talking to you, but I'm also checking my phone at the same time. We're going to lay all that down for a day a week, and we're just going to resist these things, and we're going to show, actually, because God created a world where rest is as important as work, we're going to honor that. And the third book I refer to is one I've referred to on a Sunday morning, is the book Garden City by John Mark Comer, which of all the books I've mentioned is the easiest read. The subtitle is Work, Rest, and the Art of Being Human. And the rest bit is about Sabbath. And I'll close with this. He says, we need a little menu, a little Sabbath, once in a while. And that's what the Sabbath is for. The Sabbath is a day when God has my rapt attention. It's a day when I'm fully available to my family and friends. The Sabbath is a day with no to-do list. It's a day when I don't accomplish anything and I don't feel guilty about it. It's a day when my phone is off, my email is closed, and you can't get hold of me. The Sabbath isn't a day to buy or sell to get more. It's a day to enjoy what I already have. It isn't a day to be sad, because the Sabbath is a day for menuah, for the celebration of life in God's very good world. So he picks up on the idea that I point out at the beginning from this book, which is that when God rested, he settled back to enjoy what he'd created. And John Mark Comer, who I've got a lot of time for, not that that matters, and he doesn't know who I am, so that makes no difference, does it? But I like the way, so John Mark Comer and Eugene Peterson, they've both established rhythms which they wouldn't impose on anybody else, but ways of keeping Sabbath. So Eugene Peterson and his wife, they wake up late, they read a psalm together, they go for a walk in which none of them speak, neither of them speaks, they just enjoy creation and reflect on what they've read. They sit down at lunchtime, have a picnic, wherever they happen to end up. They start talking and chatting about things. They go home, pray together, and that's the way they keep Sabbath. It's not a law, it's not a rule, but that's the way they do it. He says there are two words for Sabbath keeping, play and pray. Play and pray are his two words. That's what the Sabbath is all about. And John Mark Comer, he's also got a similar sort of routine, which he's worked out with his wife, which you can read about if you want to look into it, of just enjoying not doing, enjoying what God has created.
Is there a concept that in fact resting in what he's done
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what the Hebrews passage that I somewhat skipped over is pointing to, that we enter into God's rest. When God on day seven said, it's done now, creation is finished, I'm going to enjoy this, I'm going to enter into it, we enter into that life of trust and faith and enjoyment of the creation that God has given to us. And I don't just mean the nature, but I mean the bodies and the life and everything. So, have a chat with somebody for a couple of minutes and just pick one another's brains on all of that. If those of you that managed to stay awake for at least half of it, you must have something that's in your mind. Something that's helpful, something that's unhelpful, something that's difficult, something that's a practical thing, a biblical thing. Just have a little conversation for a moment as to what you might want to do. You might want to look at these questions if you're not somebody that talks easily. Okay, let's just draw ourselves back together for the last few minutes. Anyone got any observations, suggestions, questions? Dave, can you wait for the microphone? I've got a willing runner here, or a walker, anyway. Hang on. Will, is the hand held on? Thanks. Okay.
Oh, there we go. Okay. So the way that I find it helpful to think about this is not that it's about wisdom. So it's wise to know that God's with you every day, and every day is the same, and Jesus is there with you every day. It's wise to have time with God on a set a day aside and to rest and recuperate. So it's a matter of wisdom rather than legalism. And as soon as we get legalistic about it, I think we've lost in a way.
Yeah. So. It's a really good point, and certainly that's what the second view would say. This is part of the wisdom that God has sown into creation. So exactly that. Yeah, really helpful. It's not a law. I think another image is this is a gift. You know, this isn't a demand. This is a gift. And what a gift. Anybody else got a question or a comment? Or John?
I think also another point to make about the Christian is that Jesus appeared to his disciples, it recorded a number of times before he ascended on the first day of the week, I think the fact that the Lord's Day is only mentioned once, it's a bit flimsy in a way to just build that on scripture, on one scripture, but it's, you know, the Lord's Day is significant because it is the day belonging to the Lord.
Yeah.
And also the fact that Jesus seemed to appear, you know, he arose on the first day, Pentecost was the first day. It does seem to be a special day post crucifixion and resurrection.
Yeah, exactly. And as I pointed out, the early Christians clearly picked that up. So very early after the closure of the New Testament books, that was the habit of Christians. They picked that up, and that was the way they functioned. Yeah. Thanks. Anybody else? Janet? Yes, it's really good. If we could have different people across different sides of the room asking questions. Nick is going to be running around getting his exercise. Yeah, yeah. So someone over there next.
I think it's a really good idea to have a good think about the Sabbath, you know, because we sort of like bob along, don't we, year after year, and things come along on the Sabbath, things we do, you know. But I think it's just good to reassess the Sabbath after listening to what you said and how we might value the Sabbath that's given to us as a gift more than we do in resting and also in investing in maybe our family or friend or something. Mm. Yeah.
That's really helpful. Yeah, that's why we put it into the series. I think it is helpful to reflect and to think about it. And certainly, Myrtle and I have been doing that recently, and we don't keep Sunday as a Sabbath because for me, Sunday feels like a day of work, whether or not you think it is. But for me, it feels like it. So we keep Monday now as a day of Sabbath. And John Mark Comer makes the point in his book: you know, there's no mandated day; it is one in seven. We still obviously function on the Lord's Day with other Christians. That's why I'm here now. But we also keep Sabbath as a separate day, and which we were able to do because of our timetable, but we do as little as possible, and I try and keep my laptop in a drawer and my phone at least on silent, if not turned off, And generally we get up very late and we go for a walk and we might have lunch out somewhere. And then generally I fall asleep. It's as exciting as that. But what a privilege to be able to do that on a day, a week, and I feel that somehow that's God's gift to you. What did you say, Janet? You said reflecting on it and thinking about it. And yeah, I was going to say something else, so I'll come back to me. Anybody else got a comment or question? I'll remember that in a minute. Yes, Mark.
Having worked in Asia,
yeah,
those first New Testament scriptures, the where it talks about the others, the alien in your house,
yeah.
And we have servants
right.
in Asia a lot,
mm-hmm.
and they don't get to rest on mm. those days, and mm. but they're really into Sabbath,
mm.
so it's a real interesting mm. dilemma that they've obviously not seen,
mm.
and I've never heard before. So yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's what struck me when I was thinking about tonight, you know, those passages, how much they center on the good of other people, not just the good of ourselves, that this is healthy for society and culture. And I think in our society, in the West, and possibly around the world, I don't know, I'm not equipped to say, but certainly in the West, where we're so frantic, we're so driven, there's so much stress. And we all know the statistics about the number of people that are on antidepressants, and I'm not saying all of that is due to whatever, but we seem to live in a driven society. And it's not just our work. It's actually all the other things we find to do, which is work, even if it isn't paid employment. Ferrying our children around to X, Y, and Z, and all the other stuff that makes our lives so full. And so I think it is worth reflecting on it, as Janet said, and for the good of others too. Anybody else? At the back, Nick. Meg's got a question.
I like to think that in the Old Testament, they had to keep the law, partly legalism. But in the New Testament, we have a choice. We do it because we love the Lord.
Mm.
Mm. A big difference.
Absolutely, yeah. Very
and
good.
Would you say it's part of the New Covenant?
In what sense part of the New Covenant?
Because Jesus died for us, shed his blood.
Mm.
The new covenant came through him
mm.
and his shed blood. The worship.
Yeah, so in the context of, again, that passage in Hebrews, which I'm kicking myself for not having spent a little bit more time in, I think that's very much it. You know, this is now the good of the life that Jesus has bought for you. Enter into the rest of the Lord. Doesn't mean take every day off. It means Christ has now secured something for you which you can enjoy without having to work for it or strive for it. So in that sense, yeah, I think it is part of our new covenant existence. That's the kind of the daily experience of Sabbath, I guess. Yeah. Oh, hang on, Terry. I need Nick to run across the room. Last comment, and then we'll...
The Lord's Supper, or breaking of bread, is not exactly a commandment, but it's an invitation to remember.
Mm.
And in the guidance in Scripture that we're given, it says whenever you do it.
Mm.
So it could be any day of the week,
mm.
any time of the day.
Yes.
So that's just an invitation to worship, but it doesn't have to be on a set day.
No, exactly. And although I think the early Christians, when they did meet on the Lord's Day, did break bread, it's not true that every time they broke bread, it was the Lord's Day. So yeah, they would have done it in homes and so on. Yeah. Folks, the time has gone. As ever, I've talked much more than I meant to. I try and cut slides out, and it still just doesn't happen. So I'll try harder next month. No, don't do that. I appreciate that, but it's really not necessary. It's my day of work. It's just, you know. Oh, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. One of these, just final thought. So one of the books, I can't remember which one, I think it's John Mark Comer again, but it might be Eugene Peterson, distinguishes between a day off and keeping a Sabbath day. Because you can work all week and say, oh, I keep a day off, my day off Saturday. What do you do? Oh, I mow the lawn, I go to the shops, I pick up the stuff from the post office that Amazon couldn't deliver. You know, and it becomes a day of work, even though it's not paid employment. And so distinguishing between a day off and some sort of Sabbath day is, again, perhaps something that's helpful to reflect on. Because I used to keep Monday as a day off, but I used to work hard at home doing all kinds of odd jobs that stored up. I resist that now. Fortunately, I have a wife that doesn't care about those things, which is great. So anyway, there it is. It is what it is. You've heard what you've heard. If